We're up to lecture number 11, and we're going to talk about, we're going to continue rather with talking about navigation, but today we're going to talk about route selection. So the answer here is that now we know how to navigate around a little bit, we know how to determine our position and record it with coordinates, but how do we really get around in the landscape? How do we use maps as what's called a navigation aid, a way of actually finding our way around? So just to review in terms of position finding, that's how we determine where we are in the Earth. We've looked at how to use the environment around us, using systems like resection to determine where we are. We've looked at we've already sort of seen some of the aids to navigation, and I'm not going to introduce any or very few new ones. So we can use the map, and that includes methods like resection or just being able to interpret the map. We've looked at the compass, and I'm going to pick up one more theme on the compass today, and that's declination, which we kind of skipped over briefly before, but we're going to go into more depth now. We looked at gyro compasses and digital compasses in not particular any depth, and last lecture we spent quite a bit of time looking at the global positioning system, or GPS, and how it relates to GNSS. Okay, there's quite a lot of material in today's lecture, so I'm just going to keep blasting along here. And I want to start with this. That's the declination diagram. We've met this already. I'd like to go into it now in some more depth and understand exactly what it is. So here we are in the little graphic that we find in the corner of a topographic map, and in fact it's on all the GeoPDF maps that you've been using in class. So we've got our three norths on this map. True north, always shown by the little star representing Polaris, true north towards the North Pole. Then we have magnetic north, which, as we've seen, varies over space and over time. And the important thing is its relationship with true north. But we also now have another north on here, grid north. We'll revisit the idea of the transverse Mercator coordinate system and the fact that a local grid that might be printed on a map is also going to be misoriented with respect to both true north and magnetic north. Might want to use all three in the field, and any one of them causes problems. You got a question here?
Is the star also like geographic north?
It's sometimes called geographic north. The most common term is true north.
Because the star like sort of moves too over time, right?
Not Polaris.
Well, it doesn't move, but like in a couple thousand years, it'll be a different.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, that's indeed true. But so that I mean the geographic North Pole,
okay,
which actually also moves in a sequence called the Chandler's Wobble. But we don't want to get into that right now. Okay, we already met this idea of giving degrees and giving angles in both degrees, minutes, and seconds, and in mils. Remember, there are 6,400 mils in a circle, and that. It's advantageous for distance judging to be able to use that schedule. Okay, so let's drill down here in a lot more detail. First of all, when you're out and using a compass, and I think you're all going to get this experience this week as you begin to blunder around with compasses and figure out how to use them, we have basically two possible situations. You're either in the United States, you're either east or west of that zero declination line that kind of follows the Mississippi up from the Gulf up into Hudson's Bay. On that wonderful line, true north and magnetic north line up, but of course anywhere else in the country, like here, you have to deal with declination. So if we have west declination, what does that mean? Well, it means that the magnetic north lies to the west of true north. So if we want to correct a map, let's say we take a true bearing, that we've calculated from the map by using the up direction on the map, and we want to find out what it would be as a magnetic bearing. Let's say we've worked out a navigation route on our map, and now we'd like to transfer those to magnetic bearings that we can walk along in the field. So we would need to kind of counter-rotate the map. Well, we need to rotate the map counterclockwise to correct if we have a west declination. So we add the declination to the magnetic bearing. And the way that at least one old pilot told me to remember this, I was surfing today on the internet. I found about 20 or 30 different sort of mnemonic tools for remembering these ideas. But this is the one I like, and I'll stick with it. So if we're going from true to magnetic, that is, we're going from the map to a compass bearing, then just remember this, west is best. Okay, so if the declination is west, best means add, that's positive, so we want to add the amount of the declination to the true bearing to get the compass bearing. In this case, we've got a true bearing of 30 degrees, but we've got a declination west of 10, a magnetic declination of 10 degrees west. We add the two, we come up with a magnetic bearing of 40. If we want to do the opposite, that's go from the compass, say in our boat, to true, or what we would find on the map, we need to do the exact opposite of west is best. What if we have declination east? What if now the magnetic north lies to the east of true north? Well, here's that same 10 degrees, but now it's in the opposite direction. Here we, so to connect a true map, a true bearing, such as 30, to magnetic, we need to rotate the map clockwise in this case. And in this case, we want to subtract the declination from the true bearing. And so the opposite to west is best is that east is the least. So in least, we use subtraction. So we would take the bearing of 30, we'd subtract the declination of 10, we'd end up with a magnetic bearing of 20 degrees. Okay, and again, if we want to do the opposite, go from magnetic to true, we have to do the opposite in this instance. This is extremely important if we want to correct things. So here's the bottom line. I made this slide up because people keep referring back to this slide. It's very useful. So here's the recall. So start with the true bearing. In other words, we're going from map bearings to the compass. West is best. So if we have west declination, we add. If we have east declination, we subtract. Notice that this may result in you going over 360 degrees, in which case you just subtract 360 degrees from your bearing. And if we're going to start with magnetic north bearings, like if you're reading from a compass to begin with, or if you're reading from a compass on a boat or a plane, then you need to do the exact opposite. Okay, just worth keeping in mind. Now, one other alternative, and many compasses allow you to do this, is to permanently offset the gauge on the compass from the lever, from the dial. So this is called correcting the compass, and some of them even come with a little screw, so you can do that. I think it's probably worth just using magnetic bearings and then compensating for them if you're going to make the conversion over to the map. Just to make things more complicated, this is what we're looking at if you're flying a very minimal airplane. This is the compass, this one here. All the others are about roll, pitch, and yaw, and speed and velocity, and we're going to revisit that in just a second. So this is a gyro compass, and here we just drop the last zero off of the azimuths. So we talk about 24, where we really mean 240 degrees azimuth. All right, so we're going to be walking around the campus and using compasses. So, and I believe our start point is still the kiosk there by Campbell Hall. Is that correct? I believe so. So I thought I'd do a little bit of research on that. There's his exact latitude and longitude. And notice that varies from the center of the map, declination. So I've been teaching the class this way since 2008 when I wrote this lab. So if you look at the map declination, what's reported on the older quad, it says it's 14 degrees east. In 2008, at about this time, see, I always do this lab within 10 days of each other. So the rate seems to be pretty much constant. It's varying at 5 seconds west per year. So it's reducing the amount of east declination right here on campus. And it's gone from about 13 degrees 15 minutes in 2008 to, I just checked it today, it's 12 degrees 57 minutes right now at that point. So that's the amount that you'll need to correct by. A regular manual compass, you'd be really hard-pressed to tell the difference between 12 degrees 57 minutes and 13 degrees. So if you remember 13 east, then that's a pretty good approximation for what a declination is right now. Now, I've introduced this so far entirely in the context of magnetic declination, but the same goes for the grid north on any given map. Now, why is the grid north going to vary from true north? Well, remember that UTM projection, and the 60 times that we reproject the Earth in strips, that actually has an impact for how lat-long maps line up with the grid. I'll give you a representation of that in just a second. So if we're dealing with grid bearings, and often you will do so, you want to convert, say, magnetic bearings that you've taken in the field to grid bearings so that you can use the UTM grid on the map to draw out angles or to find coordinates. If we need to do that, look at the declination diagram. That's your biggest help because it'll tell you what the angles are. Compute any necessary change. Your magnetic north is going to be changing over time, so you may have it reported at some time in the past, in which case you have to calculate it for today. Your grid north is not going to change because we're not changing the definition of the UTM grid. But the correction that you're going to give to grid north rather depends on which side of the central meridian for the UTM zone that you are. If you remember, the UTM system divides the Earth up into 60 strips. Each one is its own zone. It goes from the South Pole to, well, not from 80 degrees south to 84 degrees north. Sets up a strip. It makes a central straight line down the middle of the zone. That's our central meridian for the zone. And that's represented as a straight line. It's only actually crossing perfectly at the equator, where we have true right angle. At every other point, it's slightly off. The further we go away from the zone, which we've numbered at 500,000 meters, so that when we get to very low numbers, like 200,000, or very high numbers, like 700,000, we're getting away from that central meridian, and the distortion in the grid is becoming increased. And again, remember, we're usually getting these values averaged at the center of a map, not at any one particular point. So if it's going to make an enormous difference to the accuracy of reporting bearings, you'll need to recalculate these. Unfortunately, these days, there are lots of web-based tools for doing exactly that. Why is this the situation? Well, imagine blowing up a UTM zone. So here's one here. That blue line represents the central meridian for the zone. Okay, if we're out here on the left-hand side in the northern hemisphere, beyond the zone, that little sort of light blue rectangle would represent the bounds of any one map that was divided by latitude and longitude. Okay, it's partitioning off an area that's with respect to true north, not to the projection. So the grid that we draw upon it, which is now parallel to the central meridian, is actually going to be at an angle to the map when it gets drawn. That's not going to be the case on the equator. It's going to be correct on the equator. So it's going to get worse as we go further and further north or further and further south. And it's also going to get worse as we go further and further east in the zone or further and further west in the zone. Okay, I'm getting these graphics redone right now because I've never been that comfortable with them. What are the implications for that? Well, on the top here, imagine that we could keep going west out here. We're very near a zone boundary here. We just go out towards Gaviota. We reach the 120th meridian, the boundary between zones 11 and 10 in the UTM system. If we go out there to that point approximately, you notice that we're down around 246,000 meters. That's way to the left of the central meridian for the zone. Okay, we're getting near the edge of the capability of the system. Our declination diagram here, you can now see grid north varying from true north by as much as 1 degree 35 minutes. That's a significant variation. I mean, it may not seem like much, but over the Earth's size, that can be quite enormous. Why is it a strange distortion? Well, imagine that we are at the UTM grid, and we're away. Here's the central meridian. If we go off to this side, here we've got the grid aligned to the central meridian, still parallel to this line. But true north is beginning to wander off in this direction. So this black arrow represents true north. The red arrow represents grid north. The red square represents my map bounded by parallels and meridians. So when I kind of cut it out and orient it towards actual north, which the sides of the map are aligned to, my grid looks increasingly distorted off. And I see that on my declination diagram, my grid north is now this side of my true north. That's exactly what we have up here. Okay, so we reach the left-hand side of the zone, the extreme side of the zone. We've got very low easterlings in the UTM zone, and as a consequence, true north, our grid north lies quite a bit to the west of grid north. Now, if we're on the other side, if we've got very large Eastings, we've got the exact opposite situation. So here we are, where this line is still parallel to that line, but this grid is becoming increasingly distorted in the opposite direction. So when we want to, when we draw that with grid north up, notice we end up with quite a bit of distortion, and our grid north in this case now lies towards the east of true north. Okay, we have to bear this in mind because this value is going to become of different magnitudes at different places on the map, and it's going to impact our ability to navigate effectively. All right, we've spent most of the time so far dealing with pretty small areas, navigating on campus and over small distances, but as we get to larger and larger distances, sort of a whole new set of rules comes into play, because so far we've seen that maps at relatively detailed scales, we can essentially ignore much of the projection distortion or the Earth's curvature. But when we begin to navigate over very long distances, we'd be kind of idiots to follow a particular parallel to get from A to B, because it's just not taking the shortest route from A to B. So we've got at least two ways of looking at this. We can talk about a great circle. So a great circle, we sometimes call it an orthodrome. It's a line of true azimuth. So imagine that this, we're going from Los Angeles to, let's say, what does that look like, Berlin or something like that. If we take a great circle route, that means that we're actually going on the circle that's made by cutting the surface of the Earth and the outside surface of the sphere. That is the shortest distance that we can go. So if we want to take off and fly and use minimum fuel, that's the route that we take. But there's another, obviously when we sail or when we fly, and we're using a compass, it's often easier to just simply follow a single compass bearing. So I always fly along bearing 35, let's say, or I take my boat out of Santa Barbara Harbor and I look at the compass and I keep, use the tiller to keep it going at 35. A line that follows a constant azimuth is called a loxodrome or a rum line. And rum line's very important in the history of navigation, because a sailor's ideal was to be able to follow one. And that's a line that crosses each successive meridian at a constant angle. So it's like it's the kind of line that would be straight on a conformal projection, but not on any other projection. Okay, so projection, how we depict this matters quite a bit, because it determines whether or not we're straight. Now, we'd love to navigate using constant directions, but we'd also like to navigate along great circles. That's how we save energy and fuel and so on. So what's normally done is to use approximation to navigate along an arc. So what do? We get the right map and we plot the great circle route. Let's say from, looks like Washington DC to Lisbon, let's say. We plot it out and it comes out as a curve. Well, it's extremely difficult to go along a curve, but we can approximate that curve as three straight line segments and calculate the bearings on each of those three legs and just simply change direction twice on route. Okay? You often see this with planes that fly out of Los Angeles. They're passing over the navigation beacon out here towards Telescope Point or Telescope Mountain, and they reset their compass to a new bearing and take them off in a different direction. That's why you see these contrails in the sky that suddenly start to curve and go off in a different direction, because they're resetting, they're approximating their great circle route into a series of legs. And look at the differences, they're quite significant. If we just simply went direct from A to B along here, we'd go 3,213 nautical miles. If we were actually able to go along a great circle using navigation, it would be 3,141 nautical miles, quite a bit less. But if we just approximate it as three legs and then go at constant bearings on three legs, we get pretty close to it. There's only a 6 nautical mile difference in that traverse. Okay, so this is how we usually navigate over long distances. We approximate great circle navigation because we can do it in aircraft with computers, but we can't necessarily do it on board a ship. Okay, so a few other details about navigation. How do we How do we deal with navigation? Well, it's pretty much uniformly determined that holding the map and using it as directly as a model of the environment and then reorienting it around your view is one of the first things that helps people to figure out where they are in the environment. Incidentally, there's only one proven spatial ability difference between males and females, and that is that males are much better at mentally rotating things in their mind. Females seem to be less able to do that. But both seem to prefer maps that rotate towards the direction of vision. So this is exploited by lots of in-vehicle systems and Google Earth, which rotates the direction of motion and puts that up rather than north. So if you're in, say, a GPS unit in your car, if you drive, that's, you're actually driving south in that direction, but it's going to appear to be forward in the map. And sometimes you pivot up and see not an overhead view of the map with the, still with direction of travel up, but you actually see it tilted, sort of in a perspective view in the environment. So we got a difference between that, and then the simplest way to do navigation in the field, where you don't, when you're not looking at a navigation device, is to simply pick a target or an intermediate target and align yourself or your map to the target. So get something in distance and figure out what you're going to have to pass through on the map to get to that particular target. We covered resection briefly, but inspection is simply using the map and looking at the features that you can see. Let's say we're standing on a hill and I can see some features, I can see some forest, I can see railroad tracks, I can see a highway and a river, and I can see them crossing with a bridge. You know, this is, there's only a finite number of places on my map where that combination of features is happening. So I can just look for it and find that particular location and locate myself just by inspecting the map. That's positioning. Finding directions, we looked at resection using a compass, but you know, if worse comes to worse, you can actually put a couple of pins in your map and hold the map up and just look across those two pins and see if you're seeing the object that the second pin is in. And now my map is aligned to the landscape. So I've used my map itself as a direct model of the landscape to be able to see objects. And if we do it and fix our location using bearings as we saw, we can use this technique of resection. Once it's oriented, once the map is oriented, it becomes much easier to use it for navigation. How do we walk along a traverse? If we're going to go from A to B, how do we do that? Okay. Well, let's say we have a task. We need to walk 5 miles along a bearing of azimuth of 35 true, let's say. Okay, how would we actually do that? Well, I'd hold 35 true by holding a compass and making sure that it remained at 35 true, checking periodically against the map, perhaps. But how can I make that a little bit easier? Because it's, you know, you're going to have to walk across difficult landscapes. You don't want to be walking the whole way looking at a compass. You'd much rather be looking up at the landscape and dealing with whatever's directly in front of you. So let's say we're standing at this point. What we should do is take the bearing that we want to walk along, 30 or whatever it is, hold it up to the landscape and look along that line of sight and see what we can see. Now, we want to see intermediate objects, like, say, an individual tree in the landscape or a little brake line there. Maybe we want to cross the ridge at a very particular location that's quite obvious because there's a certain boulder there or something like that. If we want a distant horizon point, we could pick the summits of one of those mountains, let's say in the far distance. If we want an intermediate point, we could take any one of the two power lines that are going to be visible on the map. So we just simply aim at our target. We know that that power line pole is at exactly 32 degrees. That's the bearing I want to walk along. So now I can keep, as long as I keep my head up and keep my target in sight, I can walk along and not, you know, have to go directly through each individual chaparral bush to get there. I can walk around things as long as I keep going on my consistent bearing. Okay. It's actually surprisingly easy to walk along a bearing in the open. We can do it with pretty good accuracy. So that introduces the idea of route finding. And route finding is what navigation is all about. How do we get from A to B? That really is it in a nutshell. What tactics are we going to use? Obviously, the map is going to come to our assistance, and it's our primary tool. But there are other aids to navigation that we can use, like GPS, that are going to be advantageous. But it's a lot more complex than that, okay? Because we may have different goals assigned with our navigation task. We may have positive and negative aspects about the navigation task itself. So positive, we might want to say, I want to take the path that minimizes my travel time. Or I want to take the path that manages the shortest distance between A and B. Or I want to take the path that minimizes the total amount that I'm going to have to climb to get between A and B. If it was a mountain, I'd much rather walk around it than up and down it. Or I might have other goals, like I might want to get from A to B, and I definitely want to get there alive. I don't want to fall off a cliff or have to scale a vertical face or go through a wild animal habitat. Or I might want to get lovely views as I go. I might, you know, the purpose of my visit might be to hike the most scenic route, not to necessarily take the shortest one. And then I may have intermediate locations. I may ultimately want to hike from A to B, but I would very much like to stop and have my lunch at C, which I know is a great overlook and you can see the whole passage. Then there are negative aspects in navigation. So we want to eliminate obstacles. And obstacles could be, you know, dealing with quicksand, swamps, lakes, enemy snipers, areas where there's open ground between safe locations. We might want to avoid particular locations. You know, I want to walk to my friend's house, but I definitely want to avoid my ex-girlfriend's house on the way. So I'll go two blocks out of the way to get from A to B. I might want to avoid entire areas. I definitely don't want to go through that neighborhood to get over to the park, so I'll go completely different direction. I might want to minimize the number of turns, so I might not care that I drive 10 miles out of my way. I only want to have to make one right turn, so that my navigation consists of, you know, stay on 101 to exit 100, take the exit right, and drive 5 miles and you're there. That's much better than navigating a lot of local streets. And we might want to minimize, another thing to minimize would be, say, turning left against traffic. That's very often something we want to do. And we might want to minimize risks. So we might want to try and take the safest route from A to B. And a good example is, you know, on the normal grid pattern streets, you can always avoid turning left against traffic by making three rights. So three rights can make a left in terms of navigating around. Here's some interesting work. We can use geographic information systems to actually calculate least cost paths. So if we start at A and we're going to B, we can actually tell the computer that we want to minimize the total amount of energy that we're going to expend in walking between A and B. In this case, we've got two lines. The red line is what the GIS calculated was the shortest path between two points, for two different animals in this case. And the black lines are from GPS trackers on the collars of wolves. This is in some national park or other, where they were tracking to see whether or not the wolves were following the best navigation route between A and B. And they're doing a pretty good job of it. They're following the minimum cost path across the landscape. That's quite a common phenomenon. So a few other things to bear in mind about navigation. And this is just pure psychology. I don't have an explanation for it, but I know it happens. And that is that humans, when they navigate, prefer route asymmetry. What does that mean? It means you always come back a different way. Chances are you always come back a different way. So if you take a favored route from A to B, the chances are you will not come back, that's traversing the opposite direction, over exactly the same route, or the exact same origin destination, along exactly the same path. You think about how you walk across campus every day, perhaps how you walk over here to Harold Frank Hall. You may do the same thing. You know, when I go back, I want to go by the arbor so I can, you know, check it out or whatever. This is a very common phenomenon, and I think, you know, I think it relates to humans' need to explore the environment continuously to see whether or not there's a superior route at any given time. Then navigation has hierarchy to it. You know, under ideal circumstances, if I lived at point A, this is actually the Washington DC metro map, and I wanted to get to point B, you know, if I had a sort of hover pack, Jetson's hover pack, I could just fly up into the air and go straight to B. But of course you can't do that. You have transportation systems in place. So we're going to start with mode A. Let's say it's a bicycle or a car. And we're going to have to navigate the grid system to get to the first node, which allows me to transfer onto another transportation mechanism, in this case the metro. And then, you know, I don't have a lot of decision to make. You know, maybe I'm going to change lines once. All lines go through Metro Center in Washington, D.C. I'd have to get off the red line, get on the blue line or whatever. But I don't have to make too many choices. I end up at that second node where I get off again, and now I have to deal with the local streets. I have to do local navigation again. So think about it for highway driving. You know, you might even use a completely different map or a completely different navigation process to navigate between two cities by interstate. But once you're there and you're off the interstate, now you're down to dealing with local navigation again, which is what you had to do at the very beginning of the trip to actually get onto the freeway to begin with. So this hierarchical structure is very common. And then the most common technique that we usually use for routing is to simply choose the shortest path. So if you go into, in this case, I went into Google Maps, and I typed in two locations. I wanted to go from Del Playa Park to People's Park in Isla Vista, and Google said this is what solves your problem here. You notice that I could have gone any one of several different ways. I could have gone this way, let's say. I could have come along here and gone up there. And those might have been very close in terms of total distance, but only one path usually is going to emerge as the shortest path. And according to the text here, this is going to take me 0.8 miles and take me 3 minutes or 16 minutes if I walk it. That's kind of a slow walk, I would say, to get across Isla Vista. So Google Maps here is actually applying a shortest path algorithm. It's solving all the possible paths between A and B, and it just takes the one with the shortest length. That's how it produces the results. Okay, the next thing is that people will go way out of their way to reduce their navigation into a series of legs with changes at landmarks. Okay, and this has been known since Kevin Lynch's work in the 1960s. People navigate in their landscape by memorizing places and going from place to place rather than simply memorizing legs like you would do in Dead Reckoning. Now, I put a picture of the pub on the upper left hand there because I grew up in England. And there, if anybody stopped you in the street and said, how do I get to the town hall? You would say, well, you go down there to the King's Arms and turn left. You keep going until you get to the Fox and Hounds, and then you turn right, and then it should be the third block on the right. So you use pubs to navigate in Britain, and that's how you give directions. But there are other landmarks. One of my favorites is the London Eye. The London Eye, which is a huge wheel down by Thames Embankment on the South Bank in London. It was built for the Millennium celebrations in 1999-2000. And once it was up there, everybody loved it. Everybody wanted to go on it, for one thing. But there, very quickly, people realized that you can see it from almost anywhere in London. It's a real landmark. If you can see the London Eye, you can immediately sort of set the whole geography of the city into place. So I would argue there were two reasons for leaving it there. It's become such a landmark in a city where there are a lot of tourists that it's become important. And there are other landmarks. If you had to give somebody driving directions, say in the suburbs, you'd probably say, well, you go down there to the Golden Arches, and then you turn left, and then you go down to Carrow's and you turn right, and whatever. Again, you're using landmarks which are just commonly available within the environment. And in the desert, we might use features. We might even give them names so that you can see what they resemble. Well, this is a mesa or so on. It looks like a table. Okay, a little bit of routing at sea. Do some ocean navigation here. When we get to routing at sea, it's a little bit more difficult because first of all, the sea just won't stand still. It's doing stuff all the time that we have to interact with. And then secondly, there's not a heck of a lot of landmarks out in the ocean, so we have to kind of create our own landmarks. There are plenty within sight of land, but not many out of sight of land. So we have special purpose maps that fall into different categories based upon what they're saying. We have harbor charts, which primarily deal with passage into and out of safe harbor. So you might have one harbour chart for Santa Barbara. In fact, there is one for Santa Barbara. Coast charts are for navigation on a broader scale. This might be the coastal chart that I would use to, say, take an oil tanker through the Santa Barbara Channel. And, we get a lot of fog here, but when it does clear up, just sit down and look out at the sea towards the Channel Islands on any given day, and you'll see a lot of ship traffic, some pretty big boats going past. And they're all following this channel. So these are shipping channels designed to get you from A to B and into and out of different ports on the landscape. You have general purpose charts and then sailing charts, which are specific for sailors to plot a particular route on. Some characteristics of ocean charts, well, they show azimuths and conversions, so they're, generally speaking, they're all conformal charts. They often use a Mercator projection because it's a conformal projection. They show different kinds of features, wrecks and sunken stuff and masts sticking out and that sort of thing. And these are often called hazards to navigation, so they get in the way. They're likely to be problems if you're navigating a boat. They need constant revision, constant update, because the ocean's changing all the time. You know, a buoy gets washed away in a storm, the sandbar moves its location. So every day, the Coast Guard puts out something called the Notice to Mariners, which comes out by email or digitally now, which is a daily set of revisions that you need to make to your chart. So your chart is out of date the day it's printed, and you need to go to the Notice to Mariners to update it. Generally speaking, on nautical charts, the lengths are given in nautical miles, and that's the length of a minute of arc. And remember, that's going to be different in north-south versus east-west, so it's been standardized at 1,852 meters. For speeds, we use knots, and the knot is a unit of speed equal to 1 nautical mile per hour, and that's really slow. That's 1.852 kilometers per hour. Most people can walk much faster than that, so it's approximately 1.15 miles per hour. Okay, so we give speeds at sea in knots. We get distances on maps by dividers. I'll show you an example in just a second. And we include things that matter if we're navigating, including soundings, the depth of the ocean, the sea level, the currents that we might have to deal with, and the tides, because something that may be below water at high tide is going to be above water at low tide. So we need to know the difference between those two, because it's always going to be there and we don't want to sail over it. Currents are of extreme importance, obviously, because if we're measuring our forward speed in knots, we have to subtract the speed of the current if we're moving against the current. Headwinds and tailwinds on aircraft have the same effect. I once flew across the country when we had some kind of extreme weather condition. We had this enormous jet stream condition that added I think it was like a 300 kilometer per hour tailwind to the flight. I got to Washington Dulles an hour early, and I was following the speed of the plane as we were flying, and for a little while we approached the speed of sound at sea level. That's incredible, just because of this massive tailwind. Same thing with the ocean currents. We have to know where these are and how they're moving. It's kind of handy things to know anyway, how the ocean is going to be moving. The one place where you will always see currents marked is on survival maps. So I used to have in my office, I looked for this morning, a Flying Tigers map from Asia during World War II, when the US was flying missions to China against when fighting the Japanese. And these maps were printed on fabric, so they could be screwed up and used as a handkerchief, but then would be available to you if you had to bail out over enemy territory. And the one thing that they had at sea, the only thing marked, was the directions of the currents. So if I can make a raft and get into the ocean, this is where the raft's going to go. Okay, distances and bearings, how do we deal with them? Well, on the map, distances are marked off, since we're going to use nautical miles, minutes, we can mark them along the edge of the map, and we can always put a pair of dividers up to the edge and measure off a distance. So we can now take those dividers over to the point we want to go and find a distance from anywhere. Or we can, the other thing we need to be able to tell is the direction. direction we're going to get from what's called a course at sea. The course we're going to read off of our compass. How are we going to transfer it onto the map? Well, generally speaking, on a sailing map, somewhere on the map there'll always be a compass rose showing all the azimuths, and we use one of these things, a divider. It's like a parallel ruler, which we can turn it so that it's at the right azimuth on that compass rose, and then stretch it out so that the parallel line that we need to go along is our actual course, the position we are. Now I can draw a straight line and measure off the distance with my dividers. So I can transfer my course from my instruments to the map, and from my map to the instruments with relative ease. Dead reckoning, I've mentioned this term a few times before. It's the oldest way of navigating. It's how Columbus found America, using dead reckoning. He found America. He didn't find what he wanted to find, so he didn't find point B. He found point C, of course, but that's another story. So we can use it for position finding on sea, and it also works on land. And in dead reckoning, we divide a trip up into legs. That's individual segments that have a constant course and distance. Legs can be distances and bearings only, although distances we can express in terms of time or speed, if we know times. The one thing to remember about this is that errors are additive and multiplicative. Okay, so if all of our bearings are off by 1 degree, the last bearing is going to take us way off of our target. Or if all of our lengths are overshoots by 1%, by the time we've done 10 legs, we're way beyond where we should be. Or if it's 99%, we're going to be way short of where we should be because they're multiplicative. Errors are common in the distance measurement, but they're also common in the bearing. So we're going to use regular magnetic compasses for bearings. You know, it's a real challenge to take a bearing to better than a degree or half a degree. So we're already approximating bearings when we're navigating in the exercise we're going to do on campus. This is what a typical sailing dead reckoning leg might, or set of legs might look like. We have a start point, and here we're expressing the locations in terms of the time when we got there, not necessarily the position, because the positions don't matter that much. And the constants that we have are for courses, that's the bearings, and speed in knots. So we start at 9 o'clock in the morning at 0900 at this position, and we follow a course of 90 degrees, that's true east, and then we go at a speed of 10 knots, and we're still on that leg at 10 o'clock. At 10:30 we make our course correction. Okay, so we're using time and speed as supplements for distance. Well, of course, the three are obviously very closely related to each other. Now, we use different navigation aids at sea than just simply a compass. Otherwise, you know, we'd have shipwrecks every week, pretty much. The most common technique used is radar. The radar stands for radio detection and ranging. And here we have fixed transmitters that are sending out signals from known points. We receive those signal, rather we transmit from our own. We can detect objects that are reflected from the radar and find out exactly where those are with respect to you. Okay, so we have a beam that sweeps. It usually sweeps to get all 360 degrees, and then it starts another sweep because the signal strength decays. So if you look down there at the airport, for example, they have enormous radar sitting out there in the outfield, and it's constantly turning around and, let's say, washing the UCSB campus in high-energy radar. And interpretation of this, well, it takes a skilled interpreter. Some of it can be automated, but basically we have to have human beings that know the difference between a bird and an airplane and can spot it and mark it and tag features on aircraft and follow them as they navigate through the environment. We also use radio direction finding. This is used in particular for being in the field, for navigation, and for aircraft, very common in aircraft. It works in all weather. What do? Well, we simply transmit signals from known locations, and then we use a sort of a rover to get the range and solve the ranges for position, just like we do with GPS. Here's a simple handheld unit that's used to receive a signal coming from a radio collar on an animal. So if you've ever done this, you know, biologists rush through the brush with these things trying to track the exact locations of an individual animal. The military does it, and they have mobile units for doing it, and aircraft use this as their secondary navigation system. So there are standard radio beacons transmitting. These are detected by the instruments on board the aircraft, and those are able to triangulate the points of the current position of the aircraft using an instrument that's like the one on the upper left-hand side. You will definitely see that on in every cockpit. Now at sea we have a system called Loran, and this is a sort of a nice system because it fits in very closely with cartography. So you have a master and a slave synchronized radio transmitters, usually in pairs, and they measure the time between receiving the two signals. At all equidistant points, the signals are going to arrive together. So if you're halfway between the two transmitters, you get the beep from both at exactly the same time, one beep. Anywhere else, you're going to get two beeps separated by, you'll be able to tell which one comes first and which one is second, and then there'll be a time distance between them. Now the time delays, the distance between the two signals, those are printed on the Loran charts. There are some issues with atmosphere and reception, but this system works pretty much worldwide. There's a DECA system that works outside the sort of US Navy zone, North Pacific, North Atlantic, and Mediterranean, are covered by this alternative but pretty much identical system. Very, very simple. Series of radio pulses sent out at A and simultaneously at B. If I'm exactly on this line, imagine the signal's a ping, I get one loud ping. If I'm anywhere else, I get, let's say, the B signal gets to me first, ping, ping. Signal from A comes second, and there's a gap between the two signals. If I measure the length of the gap and which signal comes first, I've got enough information to position myself with respect to the central line of that task. So this is what a Loran chart looks like. This is overprinted on a harbor chart. This is the Ambrose Channel, the famous approach to New York City and the port of New Jersey. Here's the Ambrose Lighthouse. Here, the marker of the channel itself. And all of these numbers here, all of these wave lines, these sort of contour lines, are the signal gap lengths for the Loran system. So I'd be able to get, say, one pair signal from one pair of transmitters and put myself on one of these lines, say this one. Well, now all I need to do is go to another pair of transmitters and I can put myself on another line, interpolate between the two, and that locates me down to a single point on the map. So Loran's quite nice. It works in all weathers, storms, at night, and so on. If we're navigating in the air, different ball game. We've got different maps and charts at all sorts of different scales. We've got global coverage in the World Aeronautical Chart, and the military puts out things called JOGs, or Joint Operation Graphics, which are really aeronautical charts. Just like they usually use the Lambert Conformal Conic over land areas, they're also corrected daily on something called the Notice to Airmen, or NOTAM, that's sent out. These are overseen by the FAA, and they include a lot of things related to radio direction finding, which is the secondary navigation system. Here's the Joint Operations Graphic for San Diego, and I'll point out that there are two numbers in every grid square. Here's the UTM grid marked on it. That's just not UTM, it's lat long grid. Within every one, you see a large 5 and a small 6. That stands for 5,600 feet in this case. It means that the highest thing in that square is 5,600 feet. If I'm flying higher than that, I don't have to worry about the terrain at all. If I'm lower, I do have to worry about the terrain. They have complex and very involved legends, which I'll skip for now. You can look it up. There are two primary means for flight. Basically, one that we use when you can see anything. That's called visible flight rules, or VFR. And then when you can't see anything, like you're in fog or cloud, or at night, we use instrument flight rules, or IFR. And we use different charts for each accordingly. When you take the flying test for IFR, they actually sort of put cardboard over the windows in your aircraft, and you have to fly it without once looking out of the window. They use vectors and flight plans, so to be able to fly from A to B, you have to file a flight plan in advance. And that's really just a dead reckoning log. You say, I'm going to leave from here, I'm going to go on this bearing to this location, then I'm going to follow these vectors till I get to my target. So for low altitude flight, I might go from here to here, and then here to here. I'm going to fly a constant bearing along that log. I'm just going to keep my compass on one setting as I go from A to B. Often there are important restrictions. So here's the VFR map for Santa Barbara. You notice there are all sorts of constraints on it, many of them military because of Vandenberg Air Force Base. Here's the approach area that we can go into. It says see the NOTAM directory, because there's all sorts of changes going on within that location. This is the instrument flight rules approach for Santa Barbara. You notice the three main runways, the main commercial one that runs east-west, and the two sort of light transportation routes running north-south. This is before they built the new terminal. Notice that it has a declination diagram with the rate of change. Very important, because you're dealing with compass bearings here and not true bearings. Here you are on approach to Santa Barbara. Okay, and you notice that we've got two runways and one large commercial runway each left. So you're coming in to hopefully land on 33 right there. Why is it runway 33 right? Well, we're very conveniently told the bearing of the runway. Remember, we stripped the zero off, so that's 300. That's azimuth 330 true, and that's the right runway, and that's the left. You definitely don't want to land on the wrong one. Make sure you get the correct one. Big airports like San Francisco and LAX actually have takeoffs from one and then landings on the parallel runway. We measure height with altimeters that allow us to calculate how high we are above the ground. All right, sorry I rushed through the last bit there. Here's the wrap-up. We're going to show information about direction finding. Projections and grids are obviously important. Maps are often more useful when they're oriented, so we need to move them around. Route selection, or how we choose to get from A to B, depends upon where we want to go and how we want to get there. Simplest technique is dead reckoning, and we use different charts for air, land, and sea navigation. Okay, see you on Friday.